Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and if it's January, it must be time for our annual visit with Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group. He consults investors on how politics around the world affects business, and every January he issues a report on the top political risks worldwide for the coming year. In this year's report, he argues that the U.S. economy suddenly seems like a safer bet than the so-called BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which have been seen as the main engines of growth in the world the last 5 years as the U.S. and Europe stumbled. But maybe not so much in 2013. Ian, welcome back to WNYC. Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year. Great to be back with you, Brian.
So you write that the era of emerging market abundance is finished. Really? China, India, and the others are not the shiny objects that they've been in the last few years?
Well, some are much shinier than others. The last 4 years we've really been in financial crisis aftermath, and that's been everyone focusing on the United States, and are we going to have a double-dip recession? Can we get our banks in order? Is the Eurozone going to collapse? Is Japan going to be washed into the sea? 2013 is really the first year we sort of put that behind us and realize that emerging markets, which are doing two-thirds of the world's economic growth, are actually much more unstable. Some of them are doing reasonably well, but you can't think of them in a unified way. And most of the BRICS are either places that are hard to invest in and increasingly confrontational with the West, or places that aren't growing anywhere near the way they used to.
And you get specific about many countries. And one eye-popper for me was how incredibly down you are on Russia.
On
you call Russia a submerging market as opposed to an emerging market. But Russia, as one of the BRICS, has been a market darling the last few years, largely because of energy, I think. So why are you so down on Russia?
Well, it's been almost exclusively because of energy. And of course, with the energy revolution happening now in the Western Hemisphere, unconventional oil and gas in the U.S., offshore Brazil, offshore Mexico, Canadian oil sands, gas is getting a lot cheaper. Natural gas has gotten radically cheaper as a consequence. And even the Middle East blowing up is not as important for oil prices as what's happening closer to this part of the world. So the one thing Russia's been good at, it's going to be facing some headwinds in. Meanwhile, if you want to call a country an emerging market, it should actually be emerging. I mean, it can be fitful, it can be incremental, but it should be moving towards something that is better, improved political governance, improved economic policy. There is no mechanism that you can say that is true presently for Russia. Corruption is endemic and only getting worse. Governance is appalling. There's a massive brain drain from key policy officials and thinkers in that country. And there's been a lot of capital flight, too. It's just not a good story.
Following up on what you said about energy, I'm curious. Are you one of those who thinks that the fracking for natural gas and even oil in the U.S. changes everything? I mean, some people say by 2020, the U.S. will be a net exporter of energy rather than an importer, meaning lots of new jobs in natural gas and much less entanglement with the Middle East because we'll need much less of their oil, a fundamental shift in our economics and global politics. How much are you in that camp?
I guess I am probably 80 to 90% in that camp, but many of the people in that camp believe that's a good thing. I would not make that argument. I mean, it's certainly true that there's going to be an enormous amount of economic growth. That will mean that the U.S. continues to be one of the luckiest countries in the world, and so we won't have to engage in a lot of the political decision-making on deficits until later, until it's harder, which is unfortunate. Pulling away from the Middle East probably means the Middle East gets even worse and is much more unstable. You see that in Syria. We have very little interest in getting involved in that part of the world right now. And if energy matters less to us in 10 years, that'll be more true as well. And for those who believe we need to get away from oil and gas from a climate change perspective, and this is a very complicated issue, and there's a lot more happening on climate change than just oil and gas, but it's one important point. All of this exploitation doesn't help. So I'm completely in the camp that by 2020, the United States is going to be exporting, and the U.S. will become the world's largest oil producer. That it'll take that mantle from Saudi Arabia. That is extraordinary in terms of change from where we were 3-5 years ago, but not all of it is good.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, as we talk about global politics and economics this year and compare the U.S. economy with the so-called BRICS, the emerging markets of China, Russia, India, South Africa, Brazil, which have been so hot in recent years as the U.S. and Europe have stumbled. And let's talk about China, which is the first country most Americans think of in terms of an emerging market that the U.S. competes with. China is still growing fast, isn't it?
It is, and it will be growing fast in 2013. The risk around China is not that it suddenly starts to slow. In fact, in 2012, you had a lot of people saying, oh, there's going to be a hard landing. As you know from last January, we didn't buy any of that, and we don't buy it now. But there is something changing in China quickly, and that's hundreds of millions of people that are on Weibo, China's Twitter, getting the internet. China itself believes that by 2015, 800 million Chinese will be on the internet. The government came out with that yesterday. And these are people that are, a lot of them are reading things and saying things the Chinese government's not happy about, including about the Chinese leadership itself, the Bo Xilai case, the defrocked leader from the Chinese government last year, $2.7 billion. New York Times says Wen Jiabao's family has accumulated that wealth. It's probably understated. Those things, the Chinese government is incredibly risk averse around it. They will, as a consequence, take very few risks in policy making. They'll be much more cautious and conservative. That's a problem for economic openness and political transparency. It also means that they will use the internet to try to force the conversation into areas that are less problematic for them directly. That means much more nationalism that we will see coming from China in 2013, particularly focused on places like Japan. And that's a big geopolitical tension that is looming over the course of the coming months.
I was in China in late November on a one-week tour for journalists when that David Barbosa New York Times article came out about Wen Jiabao and the incredible wealth that his family amassed while he was the head of state, basically. And that was the biggest thing that people were talking about. And the New York Times website, I gather, and the app has not been available in China ever since.
Not only that, but as of last week, he's no longer welcome in China. His visa application was rejected.
Oh, Barbosa can't go back?
That's right.
Oh, that's news that I didn't know. But at the same time, the new Chinese leaders and who is leaving power talk about corruption as a real issue. So I think they're super conflicted. And one of the things that struck me when I was there was the wildly disparate predictions that different people were making for the Chinese economy, which has shrunk from around 10% growth to 7% growth, I guess. And some people saw a soft landing from all this massive real estate investment, meaning continued 7% growth, something we would still envy in the United States. But some people fear a gigantic bursting bubble, kind of like here, when our real estate market got overleveraged. Maybe you have a prediction of your own, but what struck me was the fairly high degree of uncertainty among people I met.
Well, I think if you want to talk about 2013, consensus is actually that the Chinese economy is picking up again and they'll be 8% or higher, the World Bank, the IMF, the EBRD, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But over the longer term, precisely the policies they've put in place that have allowed for that continued growth, which has been very much state-driven, state investment-driven, fixed assets, real estate, that kind of thing, creates more uncertainty in China's medium to long-term trajectory than that of any major economy in the world. And so when you have investors all over the place saying, we're just betting the farm on China, you realize they're betting the farm on something that really has an enormous amount of gray area, enormous question mark at the end of it. And the fact that the world is being driven not by the United States and the developed economies, but that most of global growth is coming from the emerging markets, and that's only getting bigger, shows you how much uncertainty we're heading for. If you think that we've had uncertainty in the last few years, you've really seen nothing yet.
So as for the United States directly, you write in this report that political risk is now overstated despite the chaos in Congress that we report on every day. Why is that?
Well, you know, the United States certainly has political risk. You don't need to spend much time watching Washington to understand how dysfunctional congressional gridlock presently is. And in fact, I think it's going to be a much more difficult discussion over sequestration and the debt limit coming up in the spring than we've seen over the fiscal cliff. So I think, if anything, we're becoming more dysfunctional. But that happens against the backdrop of American corporations making record profits, housing picking up in the United States, the energy revolution we already talked about. I mean, the economic growth improving, unemployment going down, though from a very high base. In other words, we're not – the worst case can hit in Washington, we're not talking about the U.S. collapsing. We're not even talking about a recession. What we're talking about is that the political dysfunction in Washington is likely to put a bit of a brake on what's otherwise a pretty good story. And that's unfortunate, but that's very different from saying we have no idea what's going to happen in China.
Yeah.
The point is that downside in the developed world, the U.S., Europe, and Japan, is really bounded. It's much more constrained. Political risk just doesn't matter as much in these places. You don't see the kind of dramatic swings that you see in the emerging markets. And with emerging markets becoming a much bigger part of the global economy, political risk becomes structurally more important.
You know, before the fiscal cliff, many in business and political conservatives here, especially in the political sector, were arguing that U.S. companies have trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines because of the uncertainty from not knowing how taxes were going to change and whether Obamacare would remain in place with whatever that's going to cost them. Now we know Obama was reelected, so Obamacare is staying. They can factor that in. And the Bush tax rate debate is over. With those political uncertainties resolved, do you expect to see a tide of new investment coming off the sidelines?
Well, you know, Brian, what I want to understand is if American uncertainty was causing trillions of dollars to sit on the sidelines, how come no one ever said that Chinese uncertainty was causing American firms to keep trillions of dollars on the sidelines? This is a canard. Americans weren't investing a large amounts in the U.S. Because they didn't feel they need as many employees. They felt that productivity was going up without having to bring a lot of people back in. There were a lot of robotics going on, mechanization. There were a lot of efficiencies they found in internal processes. The U.S. companies are investing, but they're investing all over the world. They're not investing only in the United States. That's really the change. But, I mean, I don't think there were any corporates out there that were seriously saying, oh, my God, we can't put in money because what happens if Obama wins again? That's just silly.
We have a couple of minutes left. Let's end with a worldwide lightning round of some countries in your report. You ready?
Yep.
You're surprisingly bullish on Mexico. In a line, how much and why?
Quite a bit. I think the new president is moving not just on economic reform, but even on energy, and that is a big deal. That had been a third rail for Mexican politics before.
You're way down on South Africa, the last of the BRICS, which was supposed to be an emerging market darling. What do you see for the former apartheid nation that we all really want to root for?
Populism is getting only worse. We're seeing this in the mining sector, lots of social dislocation. The technocrats are streaming away from the ANC. They're leaving the party. And how sad it is that Mandela, at the twilight of his life, is not able to look over a South Africa that's doing much better.
You see Al-Qaeda, which was really irrelevant in the Arab Spring, making a comeback in the region. What are the signs?
Well, a comeback, but not necessarily a comeback against the U.S. Let's point to the fact that Al-Qaeda has declared a jihad against Assad in Syria, the first time they've declared a jihad against a non-American ally regime. This is part of growing sectarianism across the Middle East and the Horn of Africa and South Asia.
And finally, Japan, heading into its third decade of near-zero growth, but you say with little immediate impact on quality of life. Why not?
Well, I mean, first, there are fewer Japanese year in year, so they can have zero growth. The average Japanese actually does better in that environment. But also, again, it's very stable. The problem with Japan is that China is rising, and the Chinese don't like the Japanese. It's mutual. The new Japanese government is more nationalistic, and the Chinese are prepared to give as good as they get. This is a real challenge in 2013.
All right. Nice lightning round. So the takeaway and last question, you're the second guest we've had in a few weeks now saying exactly this, that the era of the BRICS is over and the era of the U.S. as, you know, economic leader resumes. The other was Ruchir Sharma, emerging markets expert for Morgan Stanley, who wrote a book. Is this the new conventional wisdom? The bricks are done. The U.S. economy is back?
No, it's not, because the U.S. is not going to be able to show anywhere near the kind of global leadership that it did before the financial crisis. The world is more complex. It's more fragmented. Standards are very different. Values are very different. Political and economic systems are very different. But the emerging markets just won't make sense as a group, and the BRICS certainly won't. I love Brazil. I love Turkey. We didn't talk about a lot of emerging markets that are actually becoming developed. But for those emerging markets that aren't becoming developed, they're going to get punished in this environment.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, his new report, The Top Political Risks of 2013. Interesting as always. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year, Brett.